Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we'll ask for calls if we want to get them later in the program. But I really don't want to interrupt, because tonight we have with us Dr. Russell Blaylock, certainly one of my favorite guests, and we're going to be talking about something that I think should be of interest to almost any adult in America today. Because we find that the people are dying because they have high cholesterol. Now, what is the definition of high cholesterol that leads to heart attack? Well, when I went to medical school, the level of cholesterol was about 280. By the time I left medicine, why, normal cholesterol was up to 230, and that was considered normal. But the drug companies really couldn't get that many people onto their drugs unless they could somehow prove that you had to get the levels down below 200, 175, 150. And of course, they have some wonderful medicines to do that. They're very effective. They poison the liver, so the liver doesn't produce cholesterol, and you can get the levels down. But does it influence longevity? Does it influence the number of people who are going to die from heart attacks? And that's the big question. The drug companies, of course, have done everything they could to convince the American people you've got to get on these statin drugs. Something like 20 to 30 million people are on these drugs, and the drug industry is one of the largest industries in the country. They make over $250 billion a year. A lot of it from drugs. Well, drugs that I'm not necessarily certain are doing that much good to prolong our lives. But that is the background. Dr. Russell Blaylock is a retired neurosurgeon, practiced in Jackson, Mississippi for many years. I've known him for a long, long time. He's written a book we carry, actually three books we carry, two of them, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life and Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills, are both available from Radio Liberty. But right now, Dr. Blaylock, thank you so very much for being with us this evening. There we are. Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
Why don't you give us a little background of what you've been able to find, because you go into all the scientific studies. The average doctor only knows really what he learns at the medical meetings, which are usually financed by the drug companies, what he reads in the medical journals, financed by the drug companies, and what he hears from the detailed men and women who come to his office smiling with free samples, who, of course, are employed by the drug companies. What's the truth about what's going on in America today?
Well, what we've seen is, and these appeared on most of the news networks and newspapers, is stories of people who were told that their blood cholesterol was slightly elevated, 220, 210, and their doctor said, well, we need to put you on this medication to lower your cholesterol. It's called a statin drug. So the person takes it, trusting his doctor, and within a short period of time, they develop muscle aches and muscle pains and weakness and fatigue. And before long, they're crippled. They're unable to get up out of a sitting position because of the intense weakness. And a significant number of these people have gone on to die. When we look at what's happened with the statin drugs, we find out that, in fact, they're quite dangerous drugs. And the very indication for which they're prescribing these drugs really is not a good indication.
All right, we're going to be back in just a few minutes with Dr. Russ Blaylock. There's much more to this story. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest this evening, Dr. Russell Blaylock. And, of course, he's been describing a condition which is known as rhabdomyolysis, which is a fancy medical term. Doctors love to use these fancy medical terms for rhabdo, meaning the skeletal muscle, and myolysis, meaning dissolution of the muscle. And I know we did have one of the statin drugs that was really well known for that. What was it, Bacor or something they took off the market?
Why, that had a high death rate.
All right, fine. But now, what about the others?
Well, if you look at the incidence of this condition with the other ones, the highest is Zocor. It was 35% incidence in an FDA study of all the different cases. Next in incidence was Pravacol matched by Liptor, and then the least was Mevacor. And this is just one complication.
Well, now, of course, what incidence are we taking? Because, you know, there must be 10 million people or more taking Lipitor today. That's really one of the most popular drugs. What percentage of those people will, of course, most of them are not going to get the flagrant rhabdomyolysis with the, certainly the dissolution of the muscle tissue and the getting the muscle pigment of the kidneys and death. What's the incidence simply of weakness that comes associated with that?
Well, they found 1 in 10 people are going to have muscle changes. When they biopsied people that were taking statin drugs, they found that the incidence of histological damage to the muscle itself was much higher than the full-blown syndrome. Now, the full-blown syndrome, where you're so weak you can hardly get out of a chair, is 1 to 7% of people that take statin drugs. Now, with their projected goal of 67 million taking these statin drugs, you're talking about millions of people coming down with a crippling condition, which in a fair number of cases ends up fatal. So it's not a minor condition, and a lot of these people never recover. You know, this is not always a reversible condition. They can be permanently crippled, unemployable, have to go on disability for the rest of their life, and some of these are quite young people in their early 40s that were talked into taking these medications.
Well, now, but what about this idea that when you take the Lipitor, when you take the other statin drugs, why you're going to cut down on the incidence of heart attack and death? I mean, after all, isn't it a cost-benefit ratio? Isn't it better, perhaps, to take something that keep you from getting a heart attack?
Well, it would be something you might consider if there were no other alternatives. But, in fact, there's a very simple supplement called Policosanol.
Hold that thought right there, Russell. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Blaylock has been just saying that if you look at the statistics of what happens when you go onto the statin drugs, they've actually done muscle biopsies. Certainly some people get extremely weak from this, but at least 1 in 10 when they do muscle biopsies have changes in the muscle, and somewhere between 1 and 7% of the people who are on these statin drugs will have the weakness associated with this as a direct result of the muscle toxicity from the statin drugs. And, of course, as they are doing everything they can to increase the number of us who are talked into taking these drugs by our doctors, and the doctors really believe what they're doing is right because, after all, the government supports this, the FDA supports it, why their medical societies support this, and why everybody's doing it. It's almost malpractice not to put people onto these various statin drugs, and yet, are they doing more harm than good? So pick up the story there, Russell, please. You were saying there are other things that really can be done to lower the cholesterol.
Right. The justification is, well, the seriousness of heart attack and stroke justifies the risk of these other side effects. But when you look at a simple supplement like polycythemol, which is just an extract of sugar cane, it's a waxy substance, at a 20 milligram dose, it does everything that they say the statin drugs will do, but it has no complications. Even in massive doses, they've never found a harmful side effect to it. But it does things that the statin drugs do not do. For instance, there's no liver toxicity with polycythemol. In fact, it's been shown to protect the liver against other toxins. It's been shown to significantly reduce brain injury in the case of strokes and heart injury in the case of heart attacks. It lowers the blood glucose, whereas statin drugs actually raise the blood glucose, making it worse for diabetics. Polycythemol lowers the blood pressure. Statins have no effect. They find it is, of course, not carcinogenic. All of the statin drugs are known to be carcinogenic or promote cancer. There has no deleterious effects on levels of coenzyme Q10, whereas statin drugs have a devastating effect on coenzyme Q10, which is a very important metabolic substance in the body. Your heart needs it, your brain needs it, all cells need it to operate. And they think that this is part of the reason for this muscle weakness, is a severe depletion of coenzyme Q10 caused by statin drugs. So here you have a simple supplement. You take 20 milligrams a day at a very small cost, comparatively, and it does everything the statin drugs are supposed to do, and a lot more, gives you protection that the statin drugs don't give you.
Well,
so it's not like there's not an alternative.
My producer wants to know how to spell this substance you're speaking of.
The polycythemol.
Right.
It's spelled P-O-L-I-C-O-S-A-N-O-L.
All right, it's available at the health food stores?
You can find almost any health food store, order it on the Internet. It's completely safe, and it's been extensively studied. It is in the cardiology journals. There's many studies on this substance that have appeared in the cardiology journals. The cardiologists that study it said all of these things are true, that it works better than statin drugs. But the reason it's not known by the public is because the pharmaceutical companies don't want you to know about it.
Well,
now, it's interesting, as you were saying, they're trying to get so many people on this. They have projected that 67 million Americans need to be on statin drugs for the rest of their life. Now, that includes 17 million diabetics, all obese people, all postmenopausal women, everybody who has high blood pressure, and everybody who lives a sedentary lifestyle. This is what the Annals of Medicine article had recommended. So that's almost half the population of the United States, they want to have it. Now they're talking about even putting children on statin drugs.
And, of course, these really do act by more or less suppressing the liver. How do they lower the cholesterol? Because ordinarily, much of our cholesterol is actually produced by our liver. And as we get older, why, of course, we need that cholesterol, you know, for a good function of our body. How do the statin drugs work on the body? Don't they?
What statin drugs do is they inhibit a critical enzyme for the formation of cholesterol, called HMG-CoA reductase. Now, what the statins do is they severely suppress this enzyme. In other words, they almost shut it off completely. And that's why people's cholesterol falls to such dramatic levels when they're on these statin drugs. Now, polycythemol also inhibits HMG-CoA reductase, but it only does it to a small degree, just enough to lower your cholesterol slightly. Now, as you say, cholesterol is essential. All your hormones from your adrenal gland that have to do with cortisol, these things are made from cholesterol. Your brain cells require high levels of cholesterol. So the brain is very dependent on cholesterol. And I think this is why we're seeing an increasing number of cases of dementia, cognitive problems in people who are taking statin drugs. And we have a growing number of cases which were confused for Alzheimer's disease. They came out to be statin drugs. When they took them off in time, the people recovered. These cases are beginning to grow, and they're reported in the medical literature. We see cases of people who have behavioral problems, irritability, short temper, difficulty with recent memories, a very common complaint, delayed reflexes, attention problems, confusion, disorientation. And one of the interesting cases, which happened to a NASA astronaut He went for his physical, regular physical. They tell him, well, your cholesterol is a little elevated, and they put him on, I think, Zocor. And within a short period of time, he became so disoriented. He had no idea who he was. He did not know where he lived. And it took a while for him to regain his memory. We call this transient global amnesia. More cases are beginning to appear of transient global amnesia associated with statin drug use. This is a very serious condition. I mean, you have no memory whatsoever during this period that you're affected by this condition. He didn't know his wife. He had no idea where he was. So we're seeing some serious brain effects of statin drugs, and it's being swept under the rug, except in the medical literature. It's being reported in the medical literature. I think there's a new book out that has collected a lot of these cases, and if you look on the internet, you'll see a lot of people taking statin drugs that are writing in saying, yes, I'm having the same problem ever since I started on this drug. I'm having difficulty with memory. I get confused and disoriented. So this is a serious, serious problem, and if you're talking about putting people on it for the rest of their life, we're going to have a lot of dementia, a lot of confusion and cognitive problems in people. Some of these things were very interesting, that study by the American Heart Association on statin drugs found that people that were taking them long-term had increasing difficulty performing everyday tasks such as driving a car. Now, this is American Heart Association, but they're not telling the general public this. They just put it in a journal, and that's sort of the end of it. The doctors don't read all these articles because they feel like they don't have time or they're too busy, and so they're not aware of it either. But there's just a growing list of problems associated with these statin drugs, and when you have 67 million people on it, this list is just going to continue to grow.
Well, I actually was reading an article written by, or at least it was a question and answer to this doctor. Apparently he's at Harvard, who's written this book on statin drugs, who thinks they're being used altogether too much. And he questions a lot of this, and especially the certain, I think there's a difference between men and women as far as the response to them. And what did the statistics really show us about the decrease in death rate and people who are taking statin drugs? Apparently it does have some effect on heart attack, but not necessarily on death rate. So what do we really know about how effective they are in really helping the people that they're prescribed to help?
Well, it's difficult to evaluate because so many of these studies are funded by the pharmaceutical companies that are selling them. So you really have to question these studies that are being funded by the pharmaceutical companies. And, to realize how much money these people are making, it is the single biggest market drug ever produced. It made $492 billion globally. Liptor alone made $10 billion. So they have a lot of money to fund research that shows that it does things that it may not do. And when you look at certain drug effects that are particularly funded by these pharmaceutical companies, we consistently find that they overstate their case, and we see that they'll say, well, there's 42% reduction in heart attack incidents in people that are on statin drugs. But those sort of things are easy to manipulate. When you look at independent drugs, we're starting to see that, well, some of this stuff doesn't quite jive. For instance, they came out and said, well, statin drugs reduce dementia and may reduce the incidence of Alzheimer's disease. But a recent study found that wasn't true. As an independent study, they found no evidence of reduction of Alzheimer's disease or dementia, and another report that appeared in a medical journal said, in fact, it may pose a danger to people not only who have Alzheimer's disease, but who inherit a risk of developing Alzheimer's disease because it interferes with the cholesterol in the brain to such a degree it won't allow these neural communication networks to work.
And I think really what's so frightening is the fact that the drug companies, if they lie to the public, nothing is ever done to them. Nobody from their staff ever goes to prison. And the pharmaceutical companies, of course, pay doctors to come up with reports. And if the doctor's report doesn't come up favorable to the drug company, they never get another study. They never get another grant. And if you're in the university environment, you're out of business. Publish or perish. You can't publish without the funds to do the studies. And you can't get the funds to do the studies Of course, if you're not in bed with the drug companies, whenever you have independent evaluations, it's amazing how different than they are, those funded by the drug companies. I think what's even more frightening is, of course, these all have to go through the FDA. And it's amazing how many FDA officials, after they complete their term at the FDA, I'm talking about the top of the FDA, then they quit and they go to work for the drug companies. But, of course, they never want to suggest that there might be a reward-benefit ratio here, but I think everybody has to understand that when we talk about getting everybody in this country on these drugs, are they really interested in helping them, or could there be? Could there possibly be another agenda? We'll be right back here with our special guest. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course, you know, it's interesting. I've been doing a fair amount of reading, but I haven't even heard of this this other medication that you're talking about, this inexpensive medication that lowers the cholesterol. What do we really know, you know, from dependable studies about the relationship between cholesterol and heart attack? Is there a definite causal relationship there? Is there some sort of a linear relationship? Does it have to do with your general health? Does it have to do perhaps with your diet in addition to that? What about simply limiting the intake of cholesterol? What are your thoughts?
Well, it's interesting when I look back to see how they ever came to the conclusion that cholesterol had anything to do with heart attacks. What I found out was that the original experiments that were done, this is way back in the 1930s, what they did is they used cholesterol and fed it to animals to see if they would produce arteriosclerosis. But what they used to dissolve the cholesterol was corn oil. And so actually they were feeding these animals corn oil, and they would develop some lesions in their arteries that looked like arteriosclerosis. So they just leaped to the conclusion that feeding cholesterol causes arteriosclerosis. And then they leaped to another conclusion that the vegetable oils would reduce arteriosclerosis. Well, what it turns out was actually it was the vegetable oil that was producing the arteriosclerosis, not the cholesterol. And that's because the vegetable oil is polyunsaturated, it oxidizes, it damages the wall of the blood vessel, and then the cholesterol accumulates in the wall of the blood vessel. But only when the cholesterol oxidizes does it cause any problems. So if you keep the cholesterol from oxidizing and you avoid vegetable oils like corn oil, safflower oil, sunflower oil, peanuts, soybean oil, if you avoid those oils, then you dramatically reduce the risk of that cholesterol becoming oxidized. And then no matter what your cholesterol is, it could be 250, 260, if it doesn't oxidize, it does not produce arteriosclerosis. So we now know that the number one cause for hardening of the arteries, arteriosclerosis, heart attack, and stroke is inflammation in the walls of the blood vessel. So the idea is, well, let's stop inflammation in the wall of the blood vessel, and the cholesterol problem is secondary. So now when we look at the best way to do that, it's nutritional. Omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin E, magnesium, taurine, the flavonoids in fruits and vegetables, vitamin C, all of these things protect the wall of the blood vessel from being inflamed, and that blocks the arteriosclerosis. Now, one of the big secrets of cardiology is that cholesterol, elevated cholesterol, has nothing to do with 50% of heart attacks and strokes.
I think that is such an important point. 50% of heart attacks and strokes are not related to cholesterol.
It has absolutely nothing to do with it.
So what are they related to?
Well, they're related to four factors. They're related to elevated LPA, which is lipoprotein A, which is hereditary. That's the people that their father had a heart attack at 45 and they have one. You inherit that gene for that LPA substance. But that can be controlled by diet as well, even though it's hereditary. Vitamin C, lysine, curcumin tends to lower that. Then the next thing is the homocysteine. And we know that when homocysteine is even slightly elevated, it dramatically increases your risk of a heart attack and stroke, far greater than cholesterol. And again, that can be controlled by nutrition, because you increase your intake of vitamin B12.
Hold that thought there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Blaylock was saying that, first of all, that about half the heart attacks are in no way related to cholesterol. And the original studies were done with animals back in the 1930s to determine whether or not giving them cholesterol would lead to heart attacks. What they did is, of course, they put the cholesterol into corn oil, and then they fed the cholesterol to the animals, and they developed arterial plaques. What they only found out many years later, it wasn't the cholesterol that was doing that. It was the corn oil. And, of course, years ago they told us, oh, you got to quit eating butter and things and ice cream and whole milk. You got to get on all these oils, you know, soybean oil and these various oils out there. They're the ones that are going to protect you, and they put them in the margarine. And actually, they were the ones that promoted the arteriosclerosis. Is that a fair statement, Russell?
Well, absolutely. And the other thing, they strongly promoted cancer and cancer growth as well.
So
now they're starting to admit that. Well, we've made a mistake. We told people to consume the wrong oil because that oil makes cholesterol oxidize, and that produces arteriosclerosis.
And then, of course, Dr. Blaylock was saying that the real problem is inflammation of the wall of the blood vessel, and that's where you really get into trouble, and that only half of the heart attacks can anyway be attributed to cholesterol. The others, and he was beginning to list the four other causes for the 50% of the heart attacks that have nothing to do with cholesterol being deposited in the wall because of the inflammation of the wall. In fact, they find C-reactive protein in about half of the heart attacks, reflecting the inflammation there. And he points out that, you know, if you are taking vitamin C and certainly vitamin E and certainly good nutrition, and he listed a number of things you should take nutrition-wise, it will cut down on the inflammation on the walls of the arteries and prevent the laying down of the plaques, which, of course, lead to the occlusion. So for the half of the people, though, the half of the cases that are nowhere related to cholesterol, and you started to list those.
Yeah, for instance, the lipoprotein A is a hereditary factor. You inherit your risk of heart attack, and it can be as high as a 70% risk if you have positive lipoprotein A elevation. That can be controlled by vitamin C, and lysine lowers that level. Homocysteine is another blood component. If it's even slightly elevated, even high normal levels are associated with a dramatic increase in risk of heart attack and stroke. The homocysteine level can be lowered with three vitamins, B6, folic acid, and B12. The levels come down normal, and the risk of heart attack and stroke falls accordingly. C-reactive protein is a measure of inflammation in your body, and we find that people who have elevated C-reactive protein have a very high risk of heart attacks and strokes. That people who consume a lot of fruits and vegetables, particularly vegetables, the C-reactive protein falls. It takes the inflammation out because flavonoids in plants are powerfully anti-inflammatory. So that's the other one. And then the final one is fibrinogen, which is a clotting factor in the blood. Some people have high levels. That means your blood clots easy, and that's what produces the heart attack. And so some of these things will reduce the fibrinogen. The polycythemia, in fact, lowers fibrinogen levels and reduces the risk. Now, if you have more than one of these four factors elevated, your risk just goes sky high. And we're talking about risk factors that are far greater than anything that you see with elevated cholesterol. The reason that this was never emphasized to the general public is because there's no drugs that will lower any of these. And since there's no drugs, physicians didn't want to deal with it because it was nutritional. So they dealt only with the half that had elevated cholesterol, and then they sold the story that it's the elevated cholesterol that's causing the problem. Well, when you look at the analysis of cholesterol, it's broken down into a lot of different types. It is only the small, dense LDL cholesterol that causes any problem at all. All the others are protective. So you can have a cholesterol of 280. If it's mainly HDL cholesterol or the large type LDL cholesterol, you're at very, very low risk. So a total elevated cholesterol tells you absolutely nothing. So you have to have the analysis to look and analyze which type of LDL you have, and that tells you your risk that it has anything to do with cholesterol. The reason that small LDL is bad is because it's easily oxidized. And that's why the antioxidants tend to protect you against heart attack and stroke.
All right, fine. Well, our guest this evening is Dr. Russell Blaylock. And when we get back from the upcoming break, why we're going to welcome your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. It's so important that you get this information and you get it to your doctor and you get the documentation on what we're saying. And when we get back, we'll tell you how to get hold of Dr. Blaylock's newsletter. And, of course, the documentation he has is excellent on all of these things. You need to have that information. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Russell Blaylock. Somebody had called in, and they wanted to go over the oils. What are the oils that really get you into trouble? The unsaturated or the saturated oil?
Well, these are polyunsaturated oils.
Polyunsaturated.
They're called omega-6 oils. This includes corn oil, safflower oil, sunflower oil, canola oil, soybean oil. Those are your major omega-6 fats. All of those produce high levels of inflammation in your body, which promotes arteriosclerosis, heart attack, and strokes. They also promote cancer by the same mechanism. Chronic inflammation is a trigger for cancer. So if you're consuming a lot of those oils, which remember the American Heart Association told you to for the last 50 years, you've put yourself at a much higher risk. And they're just now beginning to admit that in the medical literature, but not publicly to the public at large.
How could we admit to the public we've been wrong all this time and tell them to do just the opposite from what they should have been doing?
You're saying people forget they also were assuring the public that trans fatty acids cause no problem. Now, suddenly, they've had to admit that trans fatty acid is a major cause of problems, only because the medical literature is so filled with studies showing the danger of trans fatty acids, they were forced to. But people have forgotten that for years, the American Heart Association had been assuring them that these were perfectly safe oils. And we have this continuing pattern of finding the government promoting things and lying about the fact that they promoted them once they're discovered to be dangerous.
Well, let's go to John, who's calling us here from Post Falls, Idaho, I guess it is. Hi, John. How are you doing?
Hi there, I'm doing pretty well. Good evening, Drs. Monteith and Blaylock, and thank you for taking my call, Dr. Stan. I've got a comment and a question. First of all, my personal physician, Dr. William Correll, although not himself a cardiologist, works closely with the Heart Institute of Spokane and has some involvement with a study involving chelation for heart disease. I think it's both interesting and relevant to tonight's discussion that in his view it's the oxidized rather than the reduced LDL, which is a problem, which at least partially accounts for the paradox of no definitive linear relationship between cholesterol and heart disease. In other words, we're right back to free radicals as the etiology, which is what Dr. Denham Harmon came up with way back, I think it was 1957.
Okay, now did you have a question on this? And of course, what about, we'll talk a little bit later about the chelation, but did you have a question for Dr. Blaylock?
Well, I do, as the guy that wrote the book on excitotoxins, and I wanted to congratulate you, Dr. Stan, on your debate with Dr. Alan Goldhammer. I heard on John Leffler's Steel on Steel recently. Were it a boxing match, I'd certainly give you the match, although I wanted...
Hold that thought.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is John calling from Post Falls, Idaho. And, of course, he was, talking about certainly the relationship of chelation to what's going on, and certainly as far as would chelation be beneficial. We'll touch on that a little later with Dr. Blaylock. And I appreciate your words of encouragement over our recent debate with Dr. Goldhammer. Anything else you wanted to say, John?
Well, you were talking to Dr. Goldhammer, and your indictments of the drug industry, Dr. Stan, were certainly on point. They were backed up with citations and facts. And yet one thing that really bothered me about the debate is that Dr. Goldhammer got away with what I think was a very misleading rebuttal to your charge that aspartate in its constituent molecule, phenylalanine, is an excitotoxin. And Dr. Goldhammer's reaction just for the audience was, oh, how absurd, it's being an intrinsic part of foods and proteins. And Dr. Blaylock is a physician slash scientist who literally wrote the book on excitotoxins. Is it not true that phenylalanine isolate, present without moderating effects of other amino acids, is a very drug-like, and it's an excitotoxin? Isn't that true?
Well, phenylalanine is not an excitotoxin, but the aspartic acid certainly is. And this is the problem with aspartame, is that it contains toxic levels, or you'll develop toxic levels of phenylalanine, because it is toxic, but in a different type of toxicity than excitotoxicity. So you have the toxic effect of the phenylalanine, then you have, on top of that, the toxic effect of the methanol and of the aspartic acid, which is an excitotoxin. So you, what you have in the aspartame molecule is multiple toxicities. Because methanol breaks down into formaldehyde and formic acid, it attaches to the DNA and to proteins, and it's very difficult to remove, so it's an accumulative toxin. So if you drink one Diet Cola a day, you're accumulating damage to your DNA, so it's not safe. The more you drink, the more you consume, the worse the damage, and the sooner you're going to start seeing problems. Including cancer. You know, this is one of the big problems that delayed the approval of aspartame, was the 47-fold increase in brain tumors. But it also caused tumors in multiple organs. And it was only by some prestidigitation by the government that it was ever approved. But you're exactly right. These things are powerful toxins, and they know it. And people like Goldsmith, they just make these crazy statements. Of course, phenylalanine is found in the food, and of course, aspartic acid is found in foods, but it's bound, and it's slowly released so the body can metabolize it. When it's in these liquid aspartame forms, it's quickly absorbed, you reach high blood levels, it passes into the brain and causes toxicity. He knows that. I mean, he's not that big of a fool, but...
Well, we really don't want to get back to on another subject, but thanks for his call, John. Let's go to Gene from Walla Walla. Gene, do you have a question apropos to our discussion of statins?
Yes, I sure do, Dr. Stan and Dr. Blaylock. Thank you for taking my call. You're really talking to me tonight. I'm 57 years old. I just had 3 stents put in my RCA. So this has become very important to me. I've always eaten well, non-smoker. According to my physician, my C-reactive protein test is low, my homocysteine test is low, and cholesterol about 185. But I would tell everybody listening to this program tonight, don't depend on what your number of cholesterol is to determine whether you're susceptible to heart disease.
In other words, with 185, why you're still having to put the stents in.
Right.
Okay.
Family history. I have a lot of family history of this, but me and the cardiologist and my personal physician are really bumping heads over these statin drugs. And I subscribe to Dr. Blaylock's wellness newsletter, and I would certainly encourage everyone to subscribe to that.
All right.
But what I wanted to ask Dr. Blaylock is, the real measure here on this lipoprotein small a, what we really need to be looking at to see where we're at there, and what is the threshold that I should be looking for?
Well, it's not the only thing. You know, what you're doing with the LPA is primarily looking at hereditary risk.
Okay.
And if you say you have a hereditary risk of heart attack, that should have been the first test you ordered, was the lipoprotein A, because it is a hereditary factor.
Well, I just met with my physician after this, and, you know, I have to make him do this test, because even the local hospital and their laboratory, they're not equipped to make that test.
I find a lot of doctors have never even heard of cardiologists yet. It's in
right.
the medical literature, and there's a lot of new articles about it because of its strong connection. Like I said, if you have a high LPA level, it increases your risk of heart attack something like 70%.
Uh-huh.
But your level should be less than 10 milligrams per deciliter. But I would certainly get that test if the other tests are coming back fairly normal. But, you know, you're in the case now where what you want to do is prevent oxidation of your cholesterol. And the best way to do that is magnesium, taurine, and fish oils, and your vitamin C and your vitamin E.
Taking it. I'm
right.
doing that.
And,
in fact, I went on the internet and researched and ran into Dr. Pauling's research, and I'm kind of, along with his stuff and what you sent out in your letter, is kind of where I'm at.
Okay, you're taking lots of vitamin C then.
Yeah, 10,000 or 10 grams a day.
Okay, fine. I think that's a great idea. Okay.
And just one last question on
okay.
this polycosanol. You find from various manufacturers, some use sugar cane, some use rice. Is there a difference?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But the interesting thing about it, they found that doses above 20 milligrams, really, you don't get any added protection. That's sort of the maximum dose,
okay.
which makes it nice. It's relatively inexpensive compared to drugs, and so you just take 20 milligrams once a day, and it keeps things under control.
Do you think that could be the reason that it's not written up in the medical literature? It's not talked. I mean, it's written up in the medical literature, but not talked about commonly when they're talking about how we're going to stop heart attacks. Certainly, I don't think that they're going to send people around to the various hospitals to give talks on a product that they can't make any money on, because so many of these medical talks are actually financed by the drug companies.
Well, I can tell you
there's multiple articles about the beneficial effects of polycosanol and its cholesterol controlling effects. It's in the scientific cardiology journals. It's just that they can't make money, so they don't want to promote it.
Okay. Anything else, Gene?
That will do it.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen, so much.
Thank you so much. And let's quickly, one of our listeners had called in and asked, what about stopping the statin drugs? Can you stop them cold turkey? Should you gradually sort of get off them?
Well, what I would do is get started on the nutrients that you need to be on, and then you can stop them cold turkey.
All right. And
what they claim is the danger, if you stop them suddenly, then you'll have a heart attack. Well, that's if you don't take the nutrition, but if you do the nutrition, then you thin your blood, you're increasing flow through the vessels, you stop the inflammation, you stop the oxidation, so you can cold turkey stop your statin.
Well, okay, so we're talking about large doses of vitamin C and large doses of vitamin E and the fish oils, that's omega-3 oils. What else?
Well, and the magnesium is particularly important. There's a considerable amount of research that shows there's a very strong connection between arteriosclerosis and low magnesium levels. And that's because magnesium reduces inflammation, is absolutely necessary for what we call endothelial cell function. These are the cells that line all blood vessels, and they control the entire blood vessel. And the research now shows that this is the primary cause of the dysfunction or the malfunction of the blood vessel is endothelial damage. So anything that protects that endothelium protects you against heart attack and stroke. Well, that's what all of these things do. Taurine, fish oils, magnesium, they protect that endothelial lining. Vitamin C, the vitamin E, the natural form, protects that lining so that these cells function normally. It's been absolutely proven that what happens when you develop a plaque in your artery, this cholesterol plaque, when they look at it, it's filled with a very high content of free radicals. So they know that it's the free radicals that is oxidizing the cholesterol, and that's what's producing the problem, and that's what produces the sudden thrombosis that leads to the heart attack. So the primary attack should be on reducing the free radicals, and you do that as I outline in my newsletter. The newsletter goes in a lot of detail exactly what you need to know about preventing heart attacks and strokes. It's a little more than we could tell them a single program, but it's well designed to obtain these objectives. But we find these things work extremely well.
Let's tell our listeners how they can get your newsletter and how they can get to your website, too. But first of all, how can they get the newsletter?
The newsletter, you can go on www.blaylockreport.com. BLAYLOCKREPORT.com. And that's the newsletter. My personal website is www.russellblaylockmd.com. That's RussellBlaylockMD.com.
All right, that's www.russellblaylockmd.com. And then the Blaylock newsletter. Blaylockreport.com. And let's go then to let's see, Robert, he's been waiting patiently. He's in Illinois. Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I had a question for Dr. Blalock. I was wondering if what he thought of the alternative explanations of heart disease involving, one thing is, like some say, it's a nanobacteria that causes calcification, and then and also with endocarditis and things like that.
Yeah, I cover that in the newsletter, and basically what they've seen is there's a group of bacteria. One comes from the mouth. We know that people that have a lot of gum infections have a high heart attack rate, and that's because that bacteria has been isolated from the blood vessels that have the arteriosclerosis in it. So we know these bacteria circulate in the blood, and they'll implant in the wall of the blood vessel. What the bacteria are doing is they're producing inflammation, and the immune reaction against the bacteria produces the free radicals, and that's what produces the rest of the story. But there's several, like chlamydia is very strongly correlated. We find that people that are put on antibiotics tend to have less arteriosclerosis than those that have not been on antibiotics, and they figure this is because of the killing of the chlamydia. Some viruses can do it, some of the herpes virus, like cytomegalovirus. Even the influenza virus has been implicated. So we know that infectious organisms, and of course this nanobacterium is one that's been isolated. It's as small as a virus, and it tends to grow inside of concretions of calcium inside the wall of the blood vessel, which makes it very difficult to sterilize with antibiotics.
Well, now, is this like a mycoplasm, this nanobacteria you're talking about? Or?
Well, it's much smaller than a mycoplasm, okay. But it's similar in that it can be intracellular. But it tends to collect these layers of calcium around it. So when you look in blood vessels that have arteriosclerosis, you'll see calcium deposits, and this nanobacteria apparently grow in that. And I think this may be why chelation works, is because it removes the calcium, and that makes the bacteria vulnerable to antibiotics.
All right,
anything that causes inflammation in blood vessel, whether it's heavy metals like mercury, lead, fluoride, MSG, anything that causes inflammation will cause arteriosclerosis. And all of those things, mercury, lead, fluoride, and MSG, have been shown to cause inflammation of that endothelial cell lining in blood vessels. So we know that they contribute to arteriosclerosis.
Okay, Robert, anything else you wanted to ask?
So I was wondering, in that case, is there some nutritional supplement that one could take daily that would work like an antibiotic that would work against those, you know, the potential there?
One of the best is aged garlic extract. Garlic is a very powerful antibiotic, and the advantage is that bacteria never develop resistance to it, and you can take it all the time. We find that actually taking aged garlic extract is one of the few things that will actually reverse arteriosclerosis, not just stop it, but will reverse it and start opening up the walls of the vessel.
You refer to is it aged garlic extract?
Aged, yeah. Aged, what they do is they age it almost for
aged, okay.
This is the type of garlic they use in almost all the cancer experiments and arteriosclerosis, so it's a very effective form of garlic. You can buy it most anywhere.
Well, we're using something called Alamax, which is just the allicin. Is that, how does that fit in? Would that be ineffective with garlic?
It's not as effective. The aged garlic extract seems to be the most effective. In fact, it even has a smaller concentration of allicin than ordinary garlic. So it's not the allicin that seems to be the effective factor.
All right, fine. Okay, thanks very much, Robert. Let's go to Marilyn, who's calling us from Deer Park, Washington. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. Good evening, gentlemen. My husband is 65 years old. His mother and three aunts have small arteries. They've had heart attacks and angioplasties. We don't want that to happen to him. He wants to get off lovastatin. He's been on it for about 2-3 years.
What's he on?
Lovastatin.
Okay.
And he wants to get off of that. And I heard Dr. Blalock just say that if they quit cold turkey, he needs to take healthy alternatives.
Right.
We have CoQ10, 30 milligrams. And how much vitamin C and magnesium should he be taking on a daily basis then?
Well, your CoQ10 is way too low a dose at 30 milligrams.
Okay.
He should be taking at least 150 milligrams.
Okay.
Because it severely depletes CoQ10.
Now, the CoQ10 is depleted by the statin drugs.
Right.
That's what I heard him say.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's severe depletion of the CoQ10. there's evidence now that that's why there's this tremendous rise in congestive heart failure. It's because the heart needs the CoQ10 for the muscle contraction, and that taking all these statins weakens the heart muscle, and so we're seeing this explosion of congestive heart failure in the United States. Now, the, as far as the vitamin C, he needs to take the ascorbate, which is the buffered vitamin C, at least 3 times a day.
I'm sorry, how many?
A gram, 1,000 milligrams.
Okay.
The vitamin E needs to be natural form vitamin E, not the vitamin E acetate, but the natural form, which will contain all the different components of vitamin E.
Okay.
Gamma E is the most anti-inflammatory, so when you buy the natural, it has a lot of gamma in it.
Okay.
Now, come in a gel capsule. You do not want to eat the gel capsule. It's gelatin. And gelatin, high-risk mad cow disease, has fluoride in it, has MSG or glutamate in it.
Okay.
Puncture it, put it in a teaspoon, mix it with your fish oil, and take it that way. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Now, your fish oil will dramatically reduce your risk of heart attacks. One study showed a 52% reduction if you just eat fish once a week. So that shows how powerful it is.
What about borage oil?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, borage oil is DLA.
Okay.
But your fish oils, you need highly purified fish oil.
Okay.
And take that every day.
Okay. Go ahead. Well, anything else, Mary?
No, that's fine. That's fine. Thank you.
God bless. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Okay, we'll be back here in just a moment. And let's see. We have one more caller, but we'll get to him. And then the hour goes by very, very quickly when we have Dr. Blaylock on with us. So, and remember, you can get his newsletter by going to his site. And that's, of course, the Blaylock Report, www.blaylockreport.com. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. We have one final caller, and that's Tom from Ohio. Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Okay, how are you doing?
Doing just fine, thanks.
Dr. Blaylock still on?
Yes, he sure is.
I wanted to... okay, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Am I on the air?
You are on the air.
Oh.
You're being heard all over the world as we speak.
I thought it was in Africa.
You're being heard in Asia. You're being heard in the Orient, and you're being heard in Europe. So go ahead.
Well, there's a commercial on right now. I didn't know I was.
No, you're not. Don't ignore the commercial.
Okay, because I wanted my son to hear this, and he's in the other room.
Well, I'm sorry. You better bring him in there so he can hear it. But ask your question quickly, because right now, of course, we're broadcasting, but they are over the satellite. They're broadcasting a commercial. But what was the question?
Phosphoric acid, does that have anything to do with your health?
Phosphoric acid?
Yeah, and soft drinks?
Yes, it's a powerful depleter of magnesium. People that drink a lot of soft drinks are very depleted in magnesium. That increases your risk of heart attack and stroke and a lot of problems, particularly brain problems.
Will it cause an eating disorder?
Well, I'm sure it's irritating to the GI tract consuming a lot of that.
And of course, if it's a diet drink, then you're getting the aspartic acid, and that makes you obese.
Is there any over-the-counter stuff I can get to help me, like quit smoking and quit eating so much?
Well, with smoking, you just need to quit smoking, but you improve your health. I mean, if you're taking the supplements and taking the good diet, you're going to significantly protect yourself against the smoking, and as your health gets better, quit smoking.
What kind of fish oil did you just love, the regular gel caps in the bottle at the store?
It has to be liquid, not in capsules, but just liquid. They're very purified forms. They remove all the mercury and pesticide contamination.
Does GNC carry it?
No, they have, I wouldn't use their product.
Okay, they're the only thing in the neighborhood.
There's Carlson Labs. I don't know if you get on the internet, but CarlsonLabs.com, and they have a very pure Norwegian fish oil that I recommend.
Well, Well, thank you, doctors, very much. I wish there was a million more of you each. I really do. Thank you.
Just keep listening. We'll have Russell on again here, hoping in another few weeks. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, fine. Well, Russell, thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure, and we've got to let you go. We could probably keep going. We've got the whole board lit up with questions, but the time has come, and we'll be talking off the air. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, our guest has been Dr. Russell Blaylock, and I've known him for many, many years, certainly one of my favorite guests, yours too. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and we've got a couple of people on the line, Carol from Oklahoma and John from Spokane, and I hate to tell you, but Dr. Blaylock's gone, and we're just not going to get to your calls. And we've got a great, great guest for the next hour. Dr. Joel Skousen will be with us. Anyway, this is the time I want to mention that we do carry Dr. Blaylock's excellent book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, that covers a lot of what we've covered tonight. That's Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. Certainly my wife loves that book. She uses it, you know, because what they do is at the stores, they confuse a lot of the things they put in MSG, and they've got all sorts of names there so that you won't know what they've got in there. But MSG is a excitotoxin. It's something you should not be eating because, of course, it destroys brain cells just exactly as the NutraSweet does. If they are all excitotoxins, they are dangerous for you, which takes us to the second book we carry by Dr. Blaylock, entitled Excitotoxins, the Taste That Kills. So you need to get the two books by Dr. Blaylock. They're both fascinating. Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life and Excitotoxins, the Taste That Kills. Now, we have a four-tape set with Dr. Blaylock called Life-Saving Secrets that deals with many of these things. Now, it doesn't specifically deal with the statin drugs we were talking about tonight. If you want to get a copy of this tape, of course, you can call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope that many of you out there in the listening audience will want to get some of the other tapes which we have. Dr. Blaylock mentioned the danger of fluoride. We have actually two four-tape sets on fluoride. We have a DVD on fluoride. We carry the book, The Fluoride Deception by Chris Bryson. And then, of course, there's a section in Dr. Blaylock's book, Health and Nutrition Secrets, on fluoride. Excellent. My newsletter, both my November and December newsletters deal with fluoride. If you'd like to get one of those newsletters free, you can call us at 1-800-544-8927. Of course, we hope you'll want to subscribe to the newsletter because you're always going to get valuable information. The December newsletter is Dr. William Hersey's testimony before the Senate back in the year 2000. Dr. Hersey works with the Water Purification Element or Department at the EPA, and all the scientists there know that they're poisoning the American people. They've been trying to get the information out, and you'll find it in Dr. William Hersey's testimony, which is reproduced in my December newsletter. Of course, you can always get that off the Internet as well. But we'll be glad to send you one of our newsletters free of charge if you just give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. We have a four-tape set on mercury. We have a video on mercury. We have a four-tape set on aspartame. And then, of course, we carry Dr. Russell Blaylock's book on aspartame. We have a video on aspartame called Sweet Misery. And then, of course, we have the classic book on aspartame called Aspartame Disease, The Forgotten Epidemic by Dr. Roberts. I mean, this is a 1,000-page book. The only reason you get that is you really want to have all the information. And the scientific studies, it's all out there in the scientific studies. I mean, aspartame produces pathological obesity. It produces, it aggravates your diabetic condition and may even precipitate that. Of course, it can produce cancers and it can produce brain tumors and it can produce convulsions and it can produce alterations in your mind and your endocrine system. And they know all of these things. They just don't want you to know that. That was why when we did the debate this last week, and I mentioned that the active ingredients are aspartame, are methanol, aspartic acid, and, of course, phenylalanine, and the response was why phenylalanine and aspartic acid are essential amino acids. Yes, they may be essential, but in high doses they can create all sorts of problems, and, of course, the aspartic acid becomes aspartame, which is an excitotoxin. excitotoxin that is part of this whole incredible problem that destroys brain cells in excessive amounts, why it creates real problems. Well, we're out of time. I could go on, but remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And please pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and protection until Monday, may the Lord be with you. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Our telephone number out across America is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. But please hold your calls until we ask for calls, because right now we have with us Joel Skousen, the editor of World Affairs Brief, and in fact I was up on his webpage this morning, that's worldaffairsbrief.com, and I noticed that I was interviewing Joel Skousen this evening. Thank you so much for putting up there, Joel.
Well, we'll have to thank our researchers for that. They're the ones that usually try to keep track of those things.
Okay, fine. Well, of course, there's so much to talk about, so I'm just going to be quiet, which is very hard for me to do, and let you go ahead and pick up and tell our listeners what's really going on that they're not getting from the controlled media.
Well, I'm all more than pleased to give your voice a rest, Stan. I know that you are on the radio about 5 or 6 hours a day. I don't know how you do it. My hat's certainly off to you. I'm happy to do my part.
All right, Joe. The ball's in your court.
Anyway, this week's World Affairs Brief, which just came out today, I highlight my first article on spotting ulterior motives in government. This is kind of a follow-on to last week's discussion where I talked about key indications that you can recognize when our government's working towards a secret agenda. The one I talked about last week was pushing issues or programs for which there frankly is no public desire or demand. Such things as amnesty for illegal aliens, global government. There really isn't any public demand for this, nor for a constitutional amendment to have foreigners run for president. You know, these people are extremely busy, and yet they have time to push these ulterior motives, despite the fact that there's a high level of resistance among the American people. But this week, we're running into a few different types of strategies. You know, the United States has been dragging their feet and denying a problem in Iraq, denying a problem in Syria, denying a problem in Iran, denying a problem in North Korea, and they're still denying that one, and dragging their feet about doing something. And all of a sudden, they come rushing to the forefront with this issue, and suddenly it's got to be cured now. President Bush says, you know, Syria's got to get out of Lebanon right now. Well, what happened 15 years ago when this started? Bush has been president over 4 years now. Where was the outrage? I mean, Lebanon was just as oppressed 4 years ago when Bush took office, and just as oppressed when Bill Clinton took office, and yet none of these people have ever put any pressure on Syria to get out. I mean, look at Social Security. This has been a Ponzi scheme from its very beginning. It came into its first crisis in the 1980s, requiring the biggest tax increase of all times, thanks to Ronald Reagan, who most people think, did many conservative things. But, why push privatization now? These questions deserve answers. And frankly, the media never asks that question. The media never comes up and says, we find this a little strange that the president is, pushing privatization right now, or that he's pushing Syria to get out of Lebanon. This has been an ongoing problem for years. But let's look at Social Security a little more. Since the 1980s, most analysts have known Social Security is a disaster waiting to happen. It's, of course, an earned benefit. This is not supposed to be a welfare scheme, but it turned into a welfare scheme on a couple of fronts. One is that, people were allowed to collect more benefits than they actually put into the system.
Now you hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back here with Joel Skousen, editor of World Affairs Brief. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest Joel Skousen. He's pointing out that in Social Security, why initially people were getting all sorts of money out, they weren't getting money that put in, that invested. They were getting money that was being put in by the people who were working. It was a Ponzi scheme. In fact, I know doctors who paid into Social Security for 1 year and then collected it the rest of their lives. So it is simply a scheme to reward people, to buy the support of the people, and everybody feels fine until the day of reckoning comes and they find that there's not enough money in the account to actually pay the benefits that they promised. So pick up the story there, Joel.
Well, as a matter of fact, most people put in more into Social Security than they get out of it, and that's the problem. My brother and I had a very big disagreement. He was making a big issue on the fact that the way to solve Social Security is make it a means-tested welfare system. In other words, absolutely deny any benefits to people over a certain wealth level, and that would be about 3/4 of the people wouldn't get any benefits at all. And I said, this adds insult to injury. As a libertarian, I could hardly believe that my brother was promoting this. he said... His big statement was in his newsletter, why should you and I be paying for Bill Gates' retirement? Well, my response to my brother was, we're not paying for Bill Gates' retirement. Bill Gates is paying for thousands, hundreds of thousands of others' retirement because he put in far more than he'll ever get back. So this isn't a case of us subsidizing Bill Gates. It's a case of Bill Gates and every one of us subsidizing other people who are going to get far more out of this. So... The real reason, though, that the president is pushing privatization of Social Security is, in my opinion, that they have essentially created a second stock market bubble after the run-up in the 1990s, which peaked in 2000. Rather than allow the economy to settle that back out and get rid of all these high-flying stocks that were selling over price-to-earning ratios of over 200, and let those settle down, they basically created another second bubble with increased credit and inflation. And they're really kind of running low on tricks now of keeping the stock market propped up. The fundamentals want to bring it down. And I think that the powers that be really want to put a large portion of Social Security funds injecting into the stock market. Now think of this, Dr. Stan. Privatizing a portion of Social Security will channel... And by the way, I'm for a private Social Security system. I'm for getting the government out of it. I mean, the government, Social Security would be fine if the government wasn't robbing the trust fund every year to the tune of between $300 and $400 billion to pay for ordinary government expenses.
Okay, hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joel Skousen. And Joel is asking the question, why are they suddenly so concerned about Social Security? Now, we guess Social Security has been at troubles in the past. And of course, the problem with Social Security is that there is no trust fund. The government steals the money. It's been stealing the money out of the funds going back to the days of Lyndon Johnson. All you have is a bunch of government IOUs. And, of course, when they come due, where does the government get the money? They don't have the money. That's the truth of the matter. So the question is raised, why now? And Joel suggested they've created an artificial bubble in the stock market. The first one collapsed. They created another one. And do you think they're trying to keep the second bubble going for just a little bit longer?
Well, not just a little bit longer. I think that they have a long-term objective trying to keep this thing afloat. You know, they've got a problem now because they have so inflated the U.S. dollar that the dollar is falling worldwide. And so they have to curtail spending and credit creation to a certain extent, and that's why using the billions of dollars that flow into the Social Security Fund, if you can channel portions of that to the stock market, then you've got a real windfall for the markets. Now think about this, though. Think about those favored ones chosen by the Feds to make the list of so-called safe investments. I mean, these talk about insider trading. This is a huge windfall for those select few insider companies who investments or funds will make the approved list for Social Security investment fund. You know, the fees, the management fees that they cover are pittance compared to the fact that you just get this much money flowing down your fund. It's going to make some people very wealthy just by the increase in the stocks as the money flows into that. And so moving on to Lebanon, you know, we ask, you know, why now? Why not 15 years ago? Why not 10 years ago? Why not 4 years ago? This festering problem has been going on for so long. I think the U.S. is intending to attack Syria, and Lebanon is being set up as the trigger or flashpoint. The U.S. knows that Lebanon is the key invasion point for the next Arab-Israeli war, at least as long as the Syrians are denied access to the strategic Golan Heights. Now, as you might remember, in the 67 war, when the Israelis pushed the Syrians off the Golan Heights, they'd been bombarded constantly in the Jordan River Valley by the artillery from the Golan Heights. It was very important to get them off of that. That's one of the reasons, by the way, that the Israelis shot up the USS Liberty, the U.S. spy ship that was in there, eavesdropping on Israeli military conversations. The Israelis had warned, and the reason it got shot up is the Israelis had warned the U.S. three times to get the Liberty out of the water, get the Liberty out of the area, because the Israelis knew that the U.S. intelligence system had significant leaks, and it would get back to the Russians, who were manning and directing the defense of the Golan Heights. And the Israelis did not want their plans compromised. When the U.S. refused to get the Liberty out of the area, they shot it up. Now, it was mutually beneficial to both to issue a cover-up, and they did cover up, blaming neither one, saying it was an accident. It was no accident. And we had some 30 Americans die on that, and it was just a very tragic event. But a lot of people, think it's all the Israelis' fault and that the cover-up was to protect them, but the cover-up was also to protect the fact that the U.S. government, was in total communication with the Israelis about the USS Liberty. Well, I've diverted myself from the actual point, but there's several points of betrayal going on in Lebanon. One of them was the unilateral pullout of the Israelis of southern Lebanon. They were keeping Hezbollah in check. Hezbollah is the Shiite militia that, in essence, runs security for Syria in Lebanon, and when the Israelis did their unilateral pullout in May of 2000, they left the Lebanese Christian militia hanging. They were the ones who were the allies of the Israelis fighting against these radical PLO and Arab terrorists in Lebanon, and the Israelis just left them hanging high and dry, and they got a great deal of persecution, killings, some mass killings, in fact, of certain villages, men, women, and children in southern Lebanon of the poor Lebanese Christians. So, the U.S. and the Israelis both have a very bad habit of betraying their allies. So what's happening now in Lebanon is that Syria is under Bashar Assad is playing for time. He is making the pretenses of a troop pull out, but only to eastern Lebanon's Bekaa Valley. But his dreaded secret police forces, which he can try to hide but cannot afford to eliminate, are still embedded throughout Lebanon. And so is Hezbollah. Naturally, of course, the U.S. is making an issue of the secret police withdrawal. But, you know, that brings up the question, how do you prove that you've withdrawn all of your secret police? They are secret.
Yes.
And, Assad could pull out a dozen, two dozen, even 50, and the U.S. could always say, well, you haven't done enough. You've got more in there. Well, prove it to us. It's like telling the Taliban, we want you to turn over all your al-Qaeda leaders and anyone who's supporting the al-Qaeda movement. Well, how do you ever prove that you're in compliance? It's a catch-22 situation. The U.S. cannot provide you a list. They don't know. I mean, the U.S. purposely gave the Taliban an ultimatum that they could not comply with. And that's what's happened to Assad.
Well, of course, that was done in Afghanistan to justify our attack on Afghanistan. In other words, we told, as you say, the Taliban, they had to turn over Osama bin Laden and all the al-Qaeda leaders and everybody who supported them. How can you comply with that when you haven't said who you want turned over? And so they didn't immediately comply. We attacked Afghanistan. And in many respects, they're doing exactly the same thing to Syria, is the point you're making. They're making demands that they know that there's no way the Syrians can comply with. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely. Now, when I say this, I'm no fan of Syria. I've been a critic of Syria and its occupation of Lebanon ever since it began. Syria is a very serious predator country that is intending, along with Iran and Egypt, Egypt's still playing like they're an ally of the West, but they're no such thing, but they are planning on a joint missile attack on Israel. My sources in Israel indicate that that's probably planned for 2 to 3 years from now, and I think the U.S. and Israel are trying to preempt that attack by finding an excuse and provoking an excuse to be able to attack Syria and Iran before that.
But isn't Syria really, in many respects, a Russian client state today?
Of course. And so is Iran as well. Both of them have Russian and Chinese advisors in there, Russian and Chinese weapons. Iran, of course, still has some F-4s and other American weapons left over from the days of the Shah of Iran, and the U.S. has been using the withholding of parts for those American pieces of equipment as leverage over Iran. But Syria's being made out to be the boogeyman, and a boogeyman she is, but I still have to ask the question, why is the U.S. doing this now? Why, even with John Bolton, the hardliner who's just nominated as U.N. ambassador, who's been blowing the whistle on Syria now every year in the Bush administration, and they did nothing. And all of a sudden, when they want to do something, they promote John Bolton to be the antagonist at the U.N. I mean, he's not well-liked by any of the European allies who frankly, are aligned with Moscow, and Moscow is the client chief of Syria and Iran, and that's why you have this, pretensions on the part of Europe of supporting U.S. Goals for democracy, but in fact, they drag their feet because they're working for Moscow.
Well, then you're looking for a war there within a few months, relatively?
No, I still think that, it may be this year. It certainly will be by next year. It won't go that long. But I think we're going to have to see what Hezbollah does. Now, it's very interesting how the media keeps, Syria used to be the main promoter and arms supplier of Hezbollah, and they still are to many respects. But Iran came in and started to help Syria out in a major way. And Iran, of course, does have major connections with all Shiite terrorist and militia groups around the Middle East. But to continue to absolve Syria in the media and say that Hezbollah is a client of Iran is really misstating it. It still continues to get major support from Syria as well as Iran. Now, Iran is more wealthy, and so that's one of the reasons why they took over from Syria. Syria's been in very bad shape economically, and that's one of the reasons why they want to hold on to Lebanon, because Lebanon is where they do most of their banking. They have their interconnections with the Western world through Lebanon, and they don't want to lose that, you know, Syria's under sanctions.
Now, are they still growing drugs in the Baca Valley there?
Oh, of course.
And so that would be a good source of their income then for Syria, with the drugs there.
Yes, but still, you've got to remember that Beirut is a major commerce center for the Middle East, and one of the most westernized and secularized of those countries. And so Beirut is a major, major banking center. And right now, the Syrians are busy pulling out all their money out of the Lebanese banks because they fear that sanctions will be clamped down immediately and their funding will be cut off.
Well, I think it's really so interesting. I was reading this the other day that, you know, Hezbollah, why, of course, they were behind the bombing of the Marine barracks back in 1983, where some 200-plus American Marines were killed. Well, I mean, that's been known all along. They've known going back to 1983 that Hezbollah was behind that, and they did absolutely nothing about it. That is the incredible part of this story. And now we're suddenly finding out how terrible Hezbollah is. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen. And so Joel is, of course, pointing out that they've known all along of what was going on. They've known that Hezbollah was certainly a client of both Syria and Iran. And of course, but right now, of course, they're focusing our attention on it. And I think Joel's point is so well made. When you see all of the major vehicles, methods of media control and thought control focusing on one specific area, this is done in preparation for some action by our government. I really fear that Joel is absolutely right. It's only a matter of time before we are at war with Syria as well. Well, I guess is Joel Skousen. Joel, pick the story up from there.
We have to remember that Hezbollah has achieved a fair amount of sophistication in their control of Lebanon. The Shiites represent about 40% of the people in Lebanon. While that appears to be a minority, they are the largest minority. The others are the Christians, the Druze, and the Sunni Lebanese. And each of those, you know, have less than 20%, so that the Shiites are clearly the large majority. When Hezbollah decided to mount a series of demonstrations this week, instead of turning out 10,000 as the Christian Druze and Sunnis did, they turned out over 100,000. The Lebanese parliament, of course, quickly got the message. Lebanon's pro-Syrian president, Emil Aoud, with the consent of Parliament, renamed pro-Syrian Omar Karami as prime minister just 2 weeks after Karami resigned the post following massive opposition protests. So strangely, even after the opposition, you know, seems to be going along with Karami's reinstatement, and that tells you, I think, the kind of fear that Syria's secret police is and their ability to do selective assassinations, which they've done before. Now, I'm not sure at this point, in fact, I have my doubts that Syria would not have been that stupid to knock off former Prime Minister Hariri. I think that may well have been, you know, a trigger event created by forces loyal to either Israel or the CIA in order to, you know, begin this process of confrontation with Syria. If your listeners, you know, object to that concept, the United States has often engaged, just as Germany has and Russia has for many years, using agent provocateurs to begin wars. I mean, Pearl Harbor was a case in point. We have evidence now that President Roosevelt not only knew that Pearl Harbor was going to occur and failed to notify the forces on Hawaii, but he implemented a six-point provocation plan to provoke Japan into a war, including the cutoff of oil and scrap metal and other things, which left Japan choice but to attack the United States.
Well, you know, Joel, of course, everybody's forgotten the First World War and the way that the State Department did everything they could to get Americans to go on the Lusitania, knowing that the Germans were going to sink it. They knew that because the Germans were running ads in Eastern paper saying, don't go on the Lusitania, we're going to sink it. And the American State Department assured the Americans who, U.S. State Department assured the Americans who contacted them, you got nothing to worry about, go ahead and get on that ship. And then, of course, why the ship was ordered to slow down when it went into the area where the submarines were in the name of saving coal. But of course, they knew it would be a better target. The destroyer escort, which had been promised, wasn't there. The ship went down within 10 minutes. They couldn't launch their lifeboats. 1,200 people died, and well over 100 of them were Americans. That was intentionally done to hopefully to get the American people willing to go to war. Fortunately, they didn't go to war over that. That happened in actually in May of 1915. But that was what it was all about. So that technique is used over and over again. And the American people just never remember history. We don't talk about the Lusitania. We don't talk about Pearl Harbor. We don't talk about the fact that Gulf of Tonkin didn't occur. And, of course, then the question comes up as to what really happened on September 11th. But in each instance, we use that as justification to go to war. And millions and millions and millions of people die.
And we can contrast this with
Oh, that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go ahead, Joel.
We can contrast this with several nations, predator nations, very evil nations that the U.S. is still foot-dragging and ignoring the threat. Case in point is North Korea or China itself. The communist government of China is taking advantage of U.S. weakness by escalating the threat level aimed at Taiwan's independence movement. In a major propaganda move that even caught U.S. government officials off guard, the Chinese government announced this week the passage of a new law, an anti-secession law, authorizing direct military force against Taiwan should it even declare its independence from China.
And what's really so interesting, speaking of North Korea, I was just reading today where South Korea is providing a tremendous amount of logistics supplies and food and building up, doing everything they can to build up the economy of North Korea, which, of course, is this so-called rogue state that's building missiles and nuclear weapons that threaten the United States. Now, certainly, South Korea is a client state of the United States. We have our troops stationed there. They would collapse if we were to pull out all support for them, and we can manipulate them economically. So I'm sure that South Korea is not supplying material and economic support to North Korea without the full support of our government, but we would never admit that openly.
That's right, although, the president has made two statements which are bothersome in and of themselves. One, and this is a client state of Russia and China, and I think that's one of the reasons why the U.S. continues to bend over backwards to protect North Korea from prosecution. But, with a state that has declared its hostile intent, which has a massive record of weapons proliferation of nuclear material as well as ballistic missiles, the U.S. has promised North Korea, one, that it won't a demand regime change, and that it won't do a preemptive strike on the nation. I mean, how do you get that kind of guarantee when you're twice, at least twice as bad as Saddam Hussein was in Iraq or Syria ever is? I mean, North Korea is right now negotiating with Syria for delivery of the latest Scud missiles, and of course Russia's has agreed to provide very accurate modern medium and short-range missiles for Syria, which will directly target Israeli military establishments. So, the U.S. continues to play as if, China is a partner in the friendship and the negotiation regime with North Korea. But this is the same kind of game they played about Russia being an ally during World War II, and it's not an ally at all, never will be.
But it's so really what's so disheartening is the American people have forgotten that all during the 1990s, the United States provided massive food supply to North Korea. Now, that didn't go to, of course, the people. That went to the government officials and the army to keep the tyrannical government in power that was presiding over the famine and the starvation of millions of North Koreans. We were providing them oil. We were building a nuclear power plant for them. All of this supposedly so they wouldn't develop nuclear weapons, and then, aw shucks, we found out they were lying all that time. Now, I don't believe our intelligence agencies are that stupid that they would not know over almost a 10-year period that the North Koreans were lying to us. So the only other thing that I can come to is we were keeping that regime in power so it would be go ahead and build those weapons. And they never could have built those weapons if we hadn't done everything we could to keep the regime in power. Doesn't really make sense, does it?
Well, everything the U.S. has done relative to North Korea since the prosecution or lack of prosecution of the war in Korea has been with the effect of protecting China and protecting North Korea as a surrogate of China. And this plays in, of course, to the globalist agenda, that is, that you need war, and they're preparing us for a third world war. I think that the main reason why the U.S. is running around antagonizing the world, supposedly in the name of democracy. You know, when you look at Iraq, it has nothing to do with democracy. It's such a manipulated process. The entire media makes such a big deal about Iraq, you know, having such a successful election, but it isn't an election at all that's successful because the U.S. had a predetermined requirement for the election that no one could form a government without a two-thirds majority. And that just negates any kind of election. Nobody can get a two-thirds majority in a multipolar society as Iraq. And so they're stymied. The Shiites are going to have to make a deal with the Kurds or the Sunnis, and they're controlled by the Americans.
And so really it's all sort of perception, and since we will not have stability in Iraq, all sucks. We're not going to be able to bring our troops home. We're going to have to remain there, and the longer we remain, the more violence is going to be. But the real purpose behind everything, I believe, and we'll get Joel's thoughts on this when we get back, is we need a justification to keep American troops permanently stationed in the Middle East. That's what it's all about. If you don't believe that, why, you can read that report, Rebuilding America's Defenses, at the Project for the New American Century website, newamericancentury.org. They say the purpose is to keep American troops permanently stationed in the Middle East. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joel Skousen. Joel, my contention, and I want your opinion on that, is that we really don't want stability in Iraq. If we had stability, if we had a situation where they could form a government and reestablish their police force and reestablish an army, which we, of course, have destroyed intentionally, but if they could do that, then they wouldn't need us there. We would have to keep our promise and withdraw. I don't think we want to withdraw. What are your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. You're not building 14 military bases there to simply withdraw. And those are clearly being built in a permanent state, including the microwave tower system of communication between the bases and interconnecting Qatar and Afghanistan. This is a permanent military network that is being built. I'm getting communications from various soldiers clear out in the past Afghanistan and the various other Soviet republics, Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and others. We've got a military presence surrounding all of those areas, and clearly Russia knows that. If the U.S. wanted to pacify the situation in Iraq, you'd do things much, much different than the way that they are doing it. It would be relatively easy, given the amount of dissatisfaction with Saddam Hussein, to pacify the people, but the U.S. has appeared to be ham-fisted about these things. And I think, whether it's the Abu Ghraib prison scandal or stripping prisoners naked out in the middle of the desert, the U.S. is doing everything to antagonize the world and the Iraqi people to make sure that they're growing a larger insurgency faster than they're killing the insurgents. And there's even some indication, in my opinion, that I've covered that in past World Affairs briefs, that the U.S. is importing arms via Pakistan and others with Soviet markings on them and supplying insurgent militias. This indicates that the U.S. is involved to a certain extent in the insurgency.
In other words, what you're suggesting is we are actually helping the insurgents who are then fighting the Americans? We're fighting both sides?
Some of them. The insurgents mostly are targeting Americans, but even the insurgents have told other reporters, what bothers us is we don't know who's pulling off some of these car bombings. Case in point is the one that happened this last week, last Monday. Huge car bomb, killing 120 people and wounding 130. Now, this is no ordinary car bomb. The crater this car blasted created was bigger than the OKC bomb created left by Timmy McVeigh's Ryder van. This is one sophisticated bomb. You can't just pack explosives into a car and expect it to be effective. It loses its effectiveness unless you have a very sophisticated mix of explosives.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel was just saying that what's going on in Iraq, some of it really doesn't make sense. We see some very, very sophisticated explosives over there, and they're talking about this explosive last week where, of course, over 100 people were killed, another 150 or so were wounded, and this would appear to be a very, very professional car bomb, not the isolated act of a group of terrorists, but somebody built that bomb who really knew how to do it. So pick up that thought on there.
Yes, it's eerily similar to the huge car bomb that took out Prime Minister Hariri in Beirut. These two car bombs are different than anything else that's been built, and it's very, very similar, you know, to something that you know, only a very highly sophisticated professional in the explosives field can do.
And what your inference is that perhaps this has the earmarks of some sort of an intelligence organization to precipitate and continue this series of violence, this whole tragic series of events that are just keeping a turmoil going.
Well, you know, this is not, you know, an unknown occurrence. This is actually very common. You wonder when any insurgency goes around killing innocent women and children, they know that they're blackening their own name. This is exactly what's happening in Chechnya. You know, the Russians finally got, in my opinion, the real Chechen separatist leader, Aslan Makhadov. I think, in fact, they knew where he was for some time and only killed him recently for political and propaganda purposes. But all of this, you know, the death of Makhadov was really puts all the emphasis now on his competing leader, which is Shamil Basayev. Now, see, this is the rebel commander who claimed responsibility for the horrible Beslan school hostage crisis, killing over 700 people and wounding many others in the hostage situation in the theater of Moscow that killed 129. I mean, real terrorists who are freedom fighters. I made a mistake. What I'm saying, people who are really working for the freedom don't engage in acts of terrorism that kill large numbers of innocent women and children. They may engage in acts of assassination over political forces or Russian troops, but Chechens who are interested in gaining the approval of the international community aren't going around shooting up schools and blowing them up, nor theaters. In fact, you know, the two Moscow apartment bombings that were blamed on the Chechen separatists have been traced now to the KGB. So there clearly is, I think, Russian agent provocateurs in this. As you pointed out in many of your interviews, the Breslin leaders were speaking Russian. They refused to speak Chechen. In fact, they even shot two of their fellow compatriots who protested the wiring and blowing up of women and children, and they shot them on the spot. So this doesn't sound to me like these were true Chechens. I think these were agent provocateurs.
I think you're absolutely right. This was the impression that I got. And when somebody started to talk to them in Chechnyan, they said, don't talk to us in Chechnyan, talk to us in Russian. You wonder if these are really Chechnyan rebels. I mean, you have to be incredibly naive not to realize that there's something seriously wrong with this whole story.
Well, moving back to Iraq, you know, Italy is literally on fire over these killings. Here you have a journalist who happened to be a communist writing for Il Manifesto in Italy, a rabid, vociferous critic of the war in Iraq. The Italian government reportedly paid $6 million in ransom to her abductors. And then she was almost killed in an unscheduled U.S. checkpoint on the road to Damascus, Baghdad Airport. And, you know, Italy's top intelligence agent in Iraq, who had negotiated her release, was killed trying to protect this journalist, whose name was Zagrina. But you know, what we found out now is that this was not a regular checkpoint. They'd already gone through the regular checkpoint on the way to the Baghdad airport. They were in communication. In fact, they were talking in the car on the cell phone with the U.S. coordinating their movement to Baghdad airport. And when they were attacked, they were first given a light flashing light. And this was at night, mind you. You have a light flash at you, and it's very difficult to tell what's coming. There was no actual roadblock barring the road, so they just kept on going, not knowing what was happening there. Besides, they were talking on the phone to the Americans. And all of a sudden, they got hit with full automatic weapons fire. This car was riddled with hundreds of bullets, Dr. Stan. It's a miracle that she wasn't killed. And, of course, the bodyguard who threw himself over her was killed. But a real tragedy. Silvio Berlusconi, a globalist aligned with the Anglo-American establishment, one of the few in Europe who is really trying to save his political career over this, going to bat for the Americans. President Bush called and gave a euphoric apology, but still you can just feel out of the Italian press the seething hatred for the United States. I'll be surprised if Berlusconi's government can survive this.
Well, you know, the impression I get reading, of course, the reports off the Internet is this woman claims they were trying to kill me. I mean, the Americans wanted to kill me because I was critical of the war. And that seems to be the theme that's playing out in Italy today. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Yeah, that's gotten a lot of play. Those were words told to her by her Iranians. You know, the Americans are going to try to stop you, so don't let them know. And you know, frankly, I think the U.S. has targeted some journalists. There's been, almost a dozen killed in Iraq, some of them under very mysterious, some of them directly by American troops been targeted. So there may be some truth to that, but I don't think so in this particular instance because they were in communication with the U.S. These special troops were, in fact, part of a bodyguard of Ambassador Negroponte, who's the ambassador to Iraq, and he was leaving, going to the Baghdad airport sometime in the same general time frame. I can't remember whether it was before or after, and so they had set up an impromptu roadblock, checkpoint. And that's the problem. When you set up impromptu and people already go through a checkpoint, you're not expecting to stop for something else in between.
But don't you think that the radical left will do everything they can to play this up in Italy to divide the country and separate them from us and perhaps even to topple the pro-American leadership there?
Absolutely. The problem, though, is that we have so many friendly fire and trigger-happy incidents of troops. I remember in my training in the Marine Corps and as an officer, the fire discipline was just paramount. I just don't see that kind of fire discipline anymore in these troops. And I just am, when I look at Abu Ghraib, when I look at the NBC film crew leaking this, the film of this Marine shooting this unarmed, wounded Iraqi, I think there is a very not so subtle conspiracy, frankly, to continue to antagonize the world by allowing these things to happen. I don't think for a minute that someone got up there and said, all right, you're going to shoot these people to make an incident. But, I think there are ways to let things happen or to hype up your troops and just say, don't you let a single car go through if he's not going to stop by our line. You just blast them, and they do.
And, of course, these kids are scared to death. I mean, I don't blame them. If I was over there, I'd be scared to death.
Scared to death isn't an excuse for being trigger-happy.
Right.
Believe me, you Marines are capable of exercising very, very good fire discipline if they're given the proper training. So I'm really concerned here that there are just too many of these incidents going on, and they are antagonizing the world. I don't think Italy will ever be the same. You've got to remember this follows, half a dozen years from the time when American EA-6B went and clipped a
ski lift, wasn't it?
A large touring lift, killing a lot of people. And of course, the American tribunals never do find these people, guilty. They give them a slap on the hands, and this is not lost on the world. And so the United States has agreed to allow an Italian general to sit in on the inquiry, you know, to try to make it appear as if it's not going to be a whitewash, but I don't think there's any chance in the world that any heads are going to roll any more than they are over the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. You know, you just had the 10th report come out today, and once again, Congress is not looking, didn't even interview Rumsfeld, didn't try to go to the higher-ups to see where did these orders come from. It's only lower-end scapegoats. Everybody at the top is being protected.
But, of course, the people who are being sent to prison say, we were ordered to do it. And, of course, usually the phrase was, it was the contract officers who told us to do it.
Well, and that's correct. You see, that's one of the reasons why the U.S. uses these mercenaries in there, so they can have plausible deniability. It's the mercenaries who are giving the orders specifically to these guards. And of course, the guards are told by their superiors, you are to listen to what these DynCorp people say, and of course that's where the orders come down, is that you give your secret orders to DynCorp, who doesn't have to reveal anything to anybody who's supposedly a civilian, and then everyone can have plausible deniability. Very, very serious, very slick, actually, using more and more private contractors so they're not subject to the kinds of investigative and subpoena powers that we have over our own military personnel.
But of course, what has happened is America, as a Christian country, has lost the moral high ground. It no longer has moral credibility with the people of the world, because it doesn't matter whether these were contract agents or not. They have not been held responsible for what they've done.
Absolutely correct. Our government is purposely building up this cadre of mercenaries, and it's getting larger and larger all the time. The whole system, also in this week's World Affairs Brief, I talk about the fact that the U.S. sends hundreds of suspects to foreign prisons every year. And what's interesting is they've been using Syria for years. That means you've got to have an ongoing relationship with Syria. Now all of a sudden they're turning on Syria. Maybe they've used up their usefulness to them. But, they sent the Syrian... whose name was Arar, to be tortured in Syria after he was captured coming in from Canada into the United States, of which there's a major lawsuit right now, which the United States is using national security to deny any of these lawsuits. It's incredible what's happening in this regard. The Bush administration's secret program to transfer terrorists to foreign countries for interrogation has been going on for years, apparently, under a broad authority given to the CIA, no law specifically, but simply some ethereal case law and opinions by the Department of Justice that are being used to justify this. Where are the judges that should be out there saying, quote me the law, and shutting down these systems? And we've got our judges as corrupt and, I think, compliant with these with this collusion.
Well, the thing that really bothers me about this whole thing is, Joel, is that the president has said, why, we would never authorize a torture. We would never authorize, a use of brutality on people, and yet everybody knows it's going on. So why doesn't the president fire the people who are involved? I mean, when you're the head of the organization and people don't carry out your orders, why you fire them? Unless, of course, you're saying one thing and really intend another. But what really bothers me even more is the silence of the Christian community and Christian leaders, and nobody has the courage to stand up and say, this is immoral. We've lost the Christian justification for everything we do. I mean, if we are a Christian nation, how can we support leaders to do that? And nobody will say that.
Well, one of the problems, of course, is that the only opposition voices to Bush that get any press are the Democrats, and a Christian doesn't view himself as ever going to support what the Democrats do. Our voice from the further to the right of the president, from the constitutional Christian and conservative position, never gets aired in the press. So it only appears as if it's the Democrats again, and that invokes, of course, a patriotic reaction among other Christians. We can't support the Democrats. They'd be much worse than Bush. Well, they wouldn't be worse at all. They work for the same team.
And of course, the thing is that I hate to say it, but sometimes when I read the articles on the Radical Socialist Internet site, they make a lot more sense than what I see in many of the conservative sites. And yet, of course, I believe this whole thing, as you point out, is both sides are being financed by exactly the same people, and what they're doing is dividing us. Why we wouldn't support anything the communists support, and if you actually speak out against what's going on, you're immediately labeled as being pro-terrorist, or I've been called an Osama bin Laden supporter because I oppose the Patriot Act. Let's go to Mark, who's calling from Pennsylvania. Hi, Mark. Do you have a quick question?
Yeah, I just basically had a comment. Going back to Syria, guys, very interesting. I'm somewhat of a prophecy buff, and I know there's a prophecy in Isaiah 17 that many theologians have talked about over the years that talks about the destruction of Damascus. And very recently I was reading an article that talked about an Israeli general, very prominent Israeli general, by the way, that he warned of a war between Israel and Syria and the Hezbollah between now and the year 2007. So that's very, very interesting, where it just kind of comes to light with the prophetic implications.
I think you're absolutely right. Do you have any comment on that, Joel?
Yeah, that matches what my sources in Israel are telling me about the projected time frame, and I think that's what indicates why Bush and Israel are trying to provoke a war with Syria before that time, before they're ready to attack.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, it's certainly a great time to know the Lord, because otherwise, why everything over there is really confusing. None of it makes sense unless you understand the spiritual forces at work behind the scenes. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Okay, well, we've only got a couple of minutes. Well, we still got, I guess, about 5 minutes, so why don't you go ahead and pick up on your thoughts?
Well, you know, the government is more and more using hiding behind, or the misuse of national security. It continues to secrecy privilege to end lawsuits against federal government for violation of citizens' rights. Chicago Tribune said this, and I quote, "The Bush administration is aggressively wielding a rarely used executive power known as the state secrets privilege in an attempt to squash hard-hitting court challenges to its anti-terrorism campaign." Of course, it really isn't an anti-terrorism campaign. This is a campaign of suppression of civil rights to get the American people used to the fact that we can throw people in jail and keep them there. It's extremely disconcerting that this is happening, and eventually when it happens to good, patriotic Americans for opposing the government, they're going to find out why.
Well, of course, you know, this one fellow, Padilla, who has been in prison for a long period of time because he was going to build a dirty bomb, but they won't ever take him to court because they say we can't take him to court because why, we can't release state secrets. But
yeah,
You're going to have to believe us. We know he's a bad guy, and he looks like sort of a bad guy. He's obviously a Muslim, and so they've made the charge against him. He has no right of habeas corpus. He has no right to a quick trial. And we sort of dislike the guy, but well, if it can happen to him, why couldn't it happen to you or I? We'll be back here in just a minute to wrap up this evening's program. All right, we've got 3 minutes. No, Joel, go ahead.
Well, TSA is on the rampage in various airports. You know, with all of this secrecy and immunity from prosecution, It's no wonder that many of the federal employees feel that they can run roughshod over the American public and not, you know, have any backlash from it. The Transportation Security Administration, in charge of airport security, is really a case in point. Increasingly, its agents are becoming more testy and discourteous. Here's a recent comment from a mild-mannered U.S. international traveler who, up until recently, has been a big supporter of the increased security requirements, but not anymore. Here's a summary of his conversation he had with one of my researchers. Quote, "Yesterday I asked him how his trip was. He said, great until you come back to the States. The flight down, he was going to Australia, was trouble-free, as was the several months out of Sydney, his entry point. When we returned, the TSA people in San Francisco were completely out of control and actually screaming at passengers," he said, as he shook his head. My friend said, "He's not one who you can easily press for details, but this was a dramatic statement and expression for this person. Bob, not his real name, is the master of the unsaid. He's an innkeeper, very diplomatic, measured in his words. I could tell he was appalled." Now, if a mild-mannered person gets appalled, and I'm appalled as well, you know, at the way that these people just scream at you if you ever try to. You know, even if you ask them, Stan, would you please speak to me courteously, they will just come unglued, you know, accuse you of threatening them, and it's just incredible what you've got to eat in terms of pride and humility in order to get past these goons. Now, of course, it depends on what airport. I fly in and out of Salt Lake City very regularly, and these people are very, very courteous. I've never had one be discourteous. But when I get to L.A. or San Francisco, boy, it's a whole different story. I don't know who hires these people. They act like thugs.
Well, of course, I fly in out of San Jose, and I'll have to admit I haven't had any bad problems, except that every time I go to the metal check, I always set it off because I have a couple of hip implants, and of course, I always get searched. Everybody else goes right along, and I'm always the one over there getting flagged. Well, anyway, we're out of time, Joel. Thank you very much for being with us. Let's get your address and website out.
Our website, worldaffairsbrief.com. You can subscribe right online. Everything is free, actually, on the website. My analysis at the end of each week on Fridays is by a modest subscription of $36 a year. If you don't have access to the web, call a toll-free number, 877-518.
Hold that off for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening has been Joel Skousen. Joel, let's get your website and, of course, your telephone number out just one more time.
Right. The website is worldaffairsbrief.com, and the telephone number for a sample issue of the one we've been discussing tonight is area code 877. That's toll-free, 877-518-5888.
One more time.
877-518-5888.
God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us, Joel.
My pleasure, Dr.
Hope to talk to you again next week. Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, I guess this evening has been Joel Skousen. Always a pleasure as we get his analysis of what's going on in the world, and not what the newspaper says is going on, but why are they focusing our attention on this, that, or another issue? So we in America are in very real trouble because we've lost the Christian foundation. We've lost the high ground. We've lost our Christian morality. And our Christian leaders won't speak out against whatever the Bush administration is doing, because whatever they do must be good, because, after all, the president is praying every morning. He's reading his Bible every morning, and God has told him that we've got to bring democracy to the world. Well, if you really want to understand what's going on in the world today, we carry a number of books. One of them is called The Terror Timeline. That's Terror Timeline by Paul Thompson. If you haven't read it, you should. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set, a 911 update with 2-hour interviews with Paul Thompson, 2 1-hour interviews with Jimmy Walter, who spent $1 million of his own money putting out ads in the state of New York. And back there in New York, at least, most of the people realize that they've been lied to. And the Gallup poll shows that most of the people believe that the government knew the attack was coming and did nothing to stop it. We carry Jim Maher's excellent book, Inside Job. We carry another book called War on Freedom, and it's got a great deal of information, written by a British author. I think it's Rashid, but anyway, it's The War on Freedom. We have Dr. Dennis Cuddy's excellent book, 911 Prior Knowledge. We have the cover up by Dr. Cuddy. We have Peter Lance's book, Cover Up. All of these are available. We have the video that I did for the Prophecy Club, and it's called a 911, and I think it's the Prophecy Club video, 911 conspiracy. Or prior knowledge, something of the sort. Anyway, you can just call if you'd like to get any more information. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And you really need to have some grasp. The fact that the American people have not been told the truth about what really happened on September 11th. You can go to my website at RadioLiberty.com and pull down our newsletters. I think you'll be fascinated by the information that's available there. And starting really on the September 2001 newsletter, and if you just go through, you'll find out a constant pattern of deceit and deception. If there's nothing to hide, why are they hiding it? We carry an excellent book called Osama's Revenge by Paul Williams. We have the book by Robert Barron called See No Evil. He was actually a CIA agent in Iraq in 1995, and he will tell you that he never met an Iraqi who didn't believe that the United States government was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. And, of course, many of the people there believe that Saddam Hussein was working for the CIA. Robert Byrd points out that time and again the Iraqi military tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And who was it, do you think, who protected him? Why, the American State Department. And this happened while he was there. So it's a fascinating book. It's called See No Evil. In fact, he quotes one of the highest-ranking CIA officials who said, after the dust is settled, the American people will not look at 9-1-1 as a failure, but as a success. The American people will not look at 9-1-1 as a failure, but as a success. How could the death of 3,000 Americans be a success? Well, it got us into war, didn't it? Well, this is Dr. Stan asking you to pray for America, pray for revival, but play for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. Until Monday.